On this day 40 years ago, Americans were cheering their first peacetime hero since Charles Lindbergh. John Glenn, the oldest of seven U.S. astronauts at the time, became the first American to orbit the Earth. It got the United States space program moving with a vengeance. It also helped push the TV networks towards a fresh commitment to news. CBS anointed Walter Cronkite as its space anchorman, and today he reflects on that day and some of its unexpected outcomes.
It doesn't hurt a reporter's career to be in the right place at the right time with the right story. That was the good fortune I fell into with the space assignment. And the golden chalice was the flight of John Herschel Glenn when he charged into space to become the first American to orbit the Earth.
It is hoped that he does not have to come down over in the Pacific. Here's an announcement from Mercury Control.
The MHC countdown is at T-minus 20 minutes and counting. This is Mercury Control.
T-minus 20 minutes and counting for a launch at 9:45 a.m. Announcement from Mercury Control.
It was a story Americans wanted to hear in 1962, and one the government wanted told. Most of all, it was a story that television was born to tell. When the news was good, it was very good. When it was bad, the Soviets always were standing by to remind the world of their successes.
His orbital flight scheduled for today was postponed by a combination of bad weather and technical difficulties. The Soviet Union said in a broadcast to the Russian people that American officials called off Glenn's spaceflight today for fear of failure. They did not mention the bad weather. On another subject,
the truth was, fear of failure was a persistent worry. Our first unmanned space shots had been uncertain, often painful public flops. Sometimes it was the weather. Other times the reasons were buried in the Byzantine technologies that required a whole new vocabulary to express. Gantry, LOX, G-force, T-time, HiQ, squib, scrub, telemetry, trajectory. In explaining space flight, most of us correspondents learn more science than our college professors ever taught us, or maybe even knew. Fumes coming from the booster at the pad.
At the pad indicates that loxing has begun. That is, the liquid oxygen has begun to be poured into its tank aboard the Atlas. The liquid oxygen is the oxidizing agent that permits the RP-1, the kerosene, to burn at the high altitudes outside of the Earth's atmosphere, where there is no air to be a combusting catalyst agent. So the liquid
with the arms race in a dead heat, space had become the scoreboard of Cold War competition and Cape Canaveral, the main U.S. playing field. Since the first U.S. shots in 1958, the Cape had developed from a backwater Air Force test site near Cocoa Beach to a boom town of bars and motels and souvenir shops and reporters. By 1962, NASA's public relations unit hadn't nearly caught up with this technological innovation. For the first attempt at orbital flight, their press facilities were somewhere between non-existent and primitive. Out on the wilds of hundreds of acres of Cape Canaveral scrub, NASA had cleared a small spot and erected a shaky metal bleacher of perhaps 50 seats. Our CBS engineers were more innovative than the NASA flacks were. They arranged for me to broadcast the launch from the back end of a station wagon parked alongside the bleachers. With the help of an assistant waving a fan to disperse the squadrons of hungry mosquitoes, and another one beating away rattlesnakes and moccasins with a broom, we were prepared, in a sense, to report history.
Van pulled up at hangar at the pad some 15 minutes after its departure from Hangar S. Takes it that
outside of conventions and elections, CBS had never committed so much time or sacrificed so much revenue to a breaking story whose outcome was unknown. In the next 3 hours, there would be three holds, the last 6 minutes before liftoff.
Disappointed, however, if getting down to this point in the countdown, he were to be denied again. It is hoped that he does not have to come down over in the Pacific. Here's an announcement.
The MH-6 launch countdown is at T-minus 6 minutes and 30 seconds. We have encountered an electrical power failure in connection with our computers in Bermuda.
The count resumed a moment later. The capsule was sealed, and the last human controls were surrendered to the computers. It was 9:46.
1 minute.
MA-6 launch countdown is T-minus 1 minute and counting. All systems are reported in a go condition. John Glenn reports he is ready.
It's a few seconds late. It's 20 seconds now.
The Mercury spacecraft 15. Umbilical is out. Counting 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. Ignition. Liftoff. The MA-6 vehicle.
That was a critical moment. It pitched. Looks like a good flight. Oh, go, baby. We can see up there the contrails of jet fighter craft that are following this first stage of flight.
MA-6 vehicle is climbing nicely, has passed through the area of maximum dynamic pressures.
Roger, turnaround has started. Capsule turning around, and I could see the booster during turnaround just a couple of hundred yards behind me. It was beautiful. Can see clear back a big cloud pattern way back across toward the Cape. Beautiful sight.
The three orbits swung south of Russia and China airspace, cut southeast across Africa over Nigeria, and then swung northeast across the Indian Ocean toward Australia. The citizens of Perth turned on their lights to welcome Glenn as he passed almost 150 miles overhead on his first orbit.
Just to my right, I can see a big pattern of light, apparently right on the coast. Roger, that is Perth and Rockingham, you're saying there. Roger, the lights show up very well. Thank you, everybody, for turning them on, will you? Roger, sure will, John.
Most Americans didn't hear that right away. None of Glenn's communications was carried live. We expect to hear Glenn's voice.
We'll hear Glenn's voice shortly. His voice is being recorded in Mercury Control and will occasionally be played back to us as these orbits go on. That will be the choice of the Mercury Project directors, whether they will make that possible for us or not. That is to protect Glenn so that he need not be thinking about being on the air all the time and can concentrate on his scientific reports.
There was a protocol that kept reporters talking anxiously until the tapes were released.
We're expecting to hear John Glenn's voice very shortly now.
Roger, scope is retracted, light is out.
That's John Glenn.
Roger, we show valid TM on scope retract. Roger. 1-0.
It was fortunate that Mercury Control knew more about rocket science than tape recorders.
Sounds as if Mercury Control had a little trouble with their tape and feeding it back to us. That's not the way John Glenn sounded on liftoff. That was a tape being speeded up as it was played back.
It was television story in the open for all to see. My colleague Charles Collingwood summed it up well.
If anyone had doubted the wisdom of attempting America's first orbital flight in the full glare of publicity, those doubts must now be dispelled. Never before have so many people been able to participate in so great a moment of history. A whole nation was caught up in the pride, the anxiety, and the sense of sharing in history.
I had covered many space shots, but none that riveted the eyes of the nation and world as this one did, from start to a perfect finish. That night, America unwound and relaxed as Jack Parr summed up the day's events on NBC's Tonight Show.
I think it's just a glorious and wonderful thing for our country. And now they're going to have a two-man flight is the next thing. And there's the chance for Huntley and Brinkley to be in on some
on the ground floor.
Parr was wiser than he knew. There was nothing CBS would have liked more in 1962 than to see Chet Huntley and David Brinkley shot into space. Their NBC newscast had become a formidable competitor to our CBS Evening News. Maybe we should have hired them, or perhaps hired John Glenn. Glenn would have been cheaper. He earned a little less than $1,500 a month. I worked for a little more than that, but shortly after Glenn's flight, CBS picked me to be the anchor and managing editor of the CBS Evening News. As more orbital flights followed Glenn's, exciting step after exciting step, we moved toward the ultimate goal, putting men on the moon. But 40 years ago this night, as I summed up the day's astounding events, Russia still loomed large in the race to conquer space. Thanks to the ultimate courage of one man, I said, America regained some lost ground today
and narrowed the space gap. We know far more tonight than we knew at this time last night, and we offset a Russian propaganda lead. We are entitled to our emotional binge, but we are still behind the Russians. This is a moment of exultation, but not of relaxation. The director of the manned space effort, Robert Gilruth, said it. This is but the end of the beginning. This is Walter Cronkite at Cape Canaveral.
The Mercury program would lead to many wonderful things. But looking back, what's amazing is how many of the things we expected from it never happened, or at least haven't yet. And how many of the little things we overlooked have become so important to us today. In 1962, many Americans had clear memories of Lindbergh's flight 35 years before. They saw history repeating itself in Glenn's solitary courage and the ticker tape parades that celebrated his return. The implications seemed that we would all be traveling in space someday. Well, 40 years later, I still can't spend a vacation weekend on the moon or a space station. But almost every time I make a phone call, turn on a television set, or use that ubiquitous stuff we call Velcro, I'm taking a dividend from the American space program Glenn came to symbolize. The thrill of the journey had distracted us. The real story, it turned out, was in the means. It's not that history doesn't repeat itself. It's just that it does so with so much more imagination than we give it credit for. For NPR News, this is Walter Cronkite.
That report was produced by John McDonough with help from Lorna White. There's more on the story on our website, npr.org.